I'm James Simmons. This is Alternative Outlook. Welcome to Alternative Outlook. Other news sources read from a news feed in their skyscrapers. Alternative Outlook is on the ground, where people speak for themselves, producing an alternative narrative rarely heard in the mainstream media.
We also provide a platform for intellectuals who question the establishment while offering solutions ignored by those in power. Alternative Outlook is about building solidarity through illustrating the interconnectedness of struggles throughout the world and revealing a consistent, unifying struggle and theme, resisting the inherent exploitative nature and systematic shortcomings of capitalism.
I'm James Simmons. This is Alternative Outlook. Welcome to this week's episode. We are going to continue our narratives of the houseless segments that we've been putting out the last few episodes. And this one's going to be a little different in that they're going to be two houseless veterans, which is a very important aspect of understanding houselessness, because there are so many veterans that are houseless. So our first interview is with a veteran, a houseless veteran from Newark, New Jersey. His name is Vincent Harris. Enjoy.
Vincent, what led to your unfortunate circumstances?
Oh, man. That's a long story with a short ending. This goes back to 1998. I'm living at this other house on 14th Street. End up leaving there in 2000. Stayed at a shelter for about 3 months. Then moved from the shelter to a rooming house. First time I lived in a rooming house, and it wasn't that bad. Was pretty good. I ended up working for the landlord as assistant housekeeper. So that gave me a little bit of extra money. Not much money, but a little extra money. Did a little bit of everything. Me and the superintendent, I worked alongside him. We did everything. Kept busy. Ended up painted a few rooms in the place. In fact, I think I painted about 5 rooms. She didn't pay me no decent money, but she gave me $50 per room, so that was all right. And kept up normal repairs in the place, but only stayed there for about a year. Situation came up where I didn't take care of my last month's rent. Messed up on that. Because it was a decent place. But that rooming house, it closed down 2006. And I moved out in 2001. But real trip, I stayed homeless from 2001 to 2004. Oh man, I went through times. You know, you can come up and think and try to imagine the worst given situation that a man or a woman could go through if it came to be at that time for them. And I tell you, I don't think if you black, white, Spanish, Jamaican, Puerto Rican, matter woman, the worst thing that anybody can go through is coming to the reality of facing homelessness. Any given organization, business, or charity can really do for that person that he's trying to find on his own what he could provide for himself. And man, the real hardships, the seasons that come through, spring and summer, you can, you know, you actually find yourself sleeping on the street, on the common sidewalk, alongside some parking lot, some building, business building, sleeping in an alleyway, sleeping on a corner near a building, and you just there. And man, it's so bad. I still had a little bit of money still coming to me, you know, every month, but I could not find a place. I couldn't find a place. That room and house I told you I lived in, that was a blessing when it came. Clear from the blue, met this guy, he told me something. I went down, checked it out, I got the place. But hey, that was $250 a month. Psh, come on, that's a breeze. That's a given cent, you know, to a person. Man, I can afford this, let me move in. But man, after that, it's a trip. And like the hardest part of the season, wintertime. Oh, that's rough. You know, like Penn Station, downtown Newark, I'd be there like a pit stop. Because you cannot stay there and think it's like your comfort leisure moment for that time. It ain't no confirmation for a time. You there for about a half an hour, get up, go somewhere and leave. Because like security there, they ask you to leave. And you know, you don't want to get picked up on no stupid misdemeanor loitering. That's what it basically is anyway. Because you just there, hold up, just, you know, buying your time. So, that was long and short of everything. I mean, get on the train, I go to Hoboken, I go to New York, I go to Jersey City Exchange Place. Stayed about 1 or 2 days over there. So, but 4 or 4 years. Boy, you grow up quick and grow old, but you remember. Oh, you remember. And sometimes you get blessed to get a little bit of information and do a little follow-up for yourself and see what you got. That's how I ended up here at a restoration center. And that was good. That turned to be all right. So far, it's okay. It ain't that bad. I could go with a few more, give them privileges I could have if they gave them. It would be good, because I'm paying rent. But still looking for another place other than this where I can get there and settle in and see what I can make of it. But I don't know. I just take it as it comes, cause hey, shit, I ain't getting no younger. And man, all that goes to show is that when you're young, make it. Do what you can for yourself. Get established. Get it situated, get stable into it, and make a follow-up and go along with it. Make your money and save it. Because like when you're young, you can do something. You can make a star and make something of yourself.
What was your childhood like?
Oh man, it wasn't that bad. ain't from no middle class family. But we came out all right. Me and four brothers, my mother, my sister. It was okay. I ain't getting that much trouble. I wasn't that bad. I did my little stuff, but school was all right. Getting a job every now and then after school was fun, because when you like 15, 14, and you make some money, that's a good feeling. That lets you know that you can provide for yourself, put a little change in your pocket, and not a spender and save it. So that's a good feeling.
Do you get any support from the government?
No, I get Social Security disability.
Is it enough?
No, not really. It just barely puts me where I can provide to get a little so-called comfort for myself. And it's helpful.
But, you're a veteran?
Yeah.
From what war?
During the Vietnam era. I went in the Army in 75, so that was the last end of it. What ended that year, 75. 75 or 76. The only reason I joined the service, because I had a girl pregnant at the time, so I was like, I'm getting service, maybe setting up this, finish high school, do a few more years and see what I get out of this. And that turned out not to come out the way it should have came, because I ended up leaving her and started dealing with somebody else.
Do you think the government is doing a good job in taking care of its veterans?
I say so-so. It could do better when it comes to, vaccinating jobs. After being in and out the service, and affordable housing, as far as a place for us to live, as far as benefits, ain't that bad, because we get hospitalization, and everything is covered at the VA anyway.
What do you think the government could be doing more to help veterans? What would you suggest?
I say money.
More money.
Money, same benefits towards getting like a job and housing. Helping us work towards establishing, getting there, and then getting it situated to deal with as it comes.
What do you think the government doesn't do enough?
I don't know. See, you can go back 20, 30 years and see how people have protested, you know, and came forth. I went to our local congressman, councilman or mayor, and petitioned for something. It comes up a little bit at a time for what they will do and won't do, and what they've already been trying to do. So, I don't know. When they say they give like $1 billion or $800 million towards vets, I wonder, like, where the money going? Ain't going towards no pay raise, because they ain't paid me squat in 75. And I don't think they give it that much now. To me, they don't pay you enough when you get in the service. That's a look, boy, you tell somebody why you get in the service, it ain't the money. Because you ain't making no money. You is not getting no money. And you always try to do make best of it. What you do receive. So that's all that comes to that.
Do you feel that there's Anything I've missed that you would like to add?
Well, she was a certain person or group I can sit down and write a letter to and mail it to them and really get some type of agreement on, well, we'll try and we'll see what we can do. You know, that'll help a lot. You get like a
if I got you something like that and give it to you, would you appreciate that?
Yeah.
All right.
Cause,
is it that you would like? Just someone to write a letter to?
Yeah, if it was possible, because you can always go down to the Veteran Administration Building downtown North. I've been there and I know that place because they only do but so much too. It's a good building to have though. I appreciate it.
All right, well, I'll get something through Veterans Affairs and give it to Bridget to give to you.
All right,
thank you so much.
On the World Film Beat, Dennis Bro, film and television critic from Long Island University. And my next three reports will be about the Cannes Film Festival. This week, the splendor, the passion, the money, and most of all the hype that is Cannes as distribution network, one of the main functions of the festival. Next week, I'll actually talk about some of the films in the main competition, including those by Ken Loach, Mike Lee, The Dardennes, and Tommy Lee Jones. And in my third report, I'll do a roundup of films outside the main competition, which are sometimes the most interesting films of all. Altogether, there's 140 films on the program, with now six different areas of competition, a string of films outside competition, including films by Andre Tichine and Zhang Yimou, and revivals including Fellini's 8½, Renoir's La Chienne, Carnet's Daybreak, or La Jour se lève. And those revivals are films you'll be seeing throughout the year. They'll make their way to all the different sort of museums and repertory shows, as will all the films in the other competitions. Slowly they start to filter out, and they'll be in the U.S., during the year. Finally, this year, Quentin Tarantino will introduce Sergio Leone's Fistful of Dollars for its 50th anniversary as the closing night of the festival. It sounds special, but actually they couldn't find an opening night film to take the prestigious spot, which does highlight the fact that the films thus far have been a bit on the underwhelming side. The jury headed by Jane Campion, whose feminist television serial Top of the Lake was the second television series to ever play at Cannes, and also consisting of the Mexican actor and cinema activist Gael Garcia Bernal, and the great Chinese director Zhu Zhangke, is in a way sort of more interesting than the films. So the first thing I want to talk about is opening night, and that was the film Grace, which, as opening nights go, is milder than most as a cinematic entry. Wasn't 2010's Robin Hood or an American big-budget spectacular, but rather a film by a French director, Olivier Dahan, who had previously directed La Môme on Edith Piaf. All but this film with Uma Thurman as Grace Kelly, the Princess of Monaco in the early 1960s. Which the Weinsteins, ex of Miramax, will be distributing in the U.S. And, of course, there were two Cannes controversies. The first centered around Harvey Weinstein and the cutting of the film. As we all know, he's also known as Harvey Scissorhands. He made his reputation cutting Euro longer productions and getting them ready for Middle America. The French also refer to him as L'Homme de Soixante Statut, that is, the man of 60 Oscars. Well, Harvey wanted to cut the film. Dahan said no, and the director's cut opened the festival. This controversy over his cutting of Grace, with the Cinéma des Auteurs French director resisting, goes to the heart of the matter here for the French, which is whether the Cinéma des Auteurs, that is the film built around the personal vision of a director working within the French finance system, will survive. Financing is now a major problem, and the state still has not figured out how to tax the online companies who are putting the films up on the internet for free, which is the biggest loophole at the moment. Distributing has shifted as in the U.S. It used to be there was a second and third level of financing after the theatrical opening. The second level was the DVD, but DVD sales are drying up. They've plunged 50%, with streaming giving the impression that cinema is free. And then the third level is what we call pay-per-view. Here, that's Canal Plus, which then was forced to finance films by the state. But as I said, films are going up on the internet for free, so the French indies now say they're on the side of Warners and figuring out a way to halt the piratage or pirating, though those on the other side simply call it watching films for free. Just to give you an idea, there's sort of three tiers of French financing or levels of auteurs. One is a level of about $1 million, and this year that's Matthew Almerich, who's adapting a Simeon film called La Chambre Bleue in the En Certain Regard, which is this kind of second level of competition. And James Charles Hugh, whose film Mange des Tours, or Eat Your Dead, was about 1.6 million euros, and that's in the Canzon des Realisateurs, both of which I'll be talking about in a couple of weeks. And the middle level is a film, films like Bird People, which is called a romance fantastique, which is about six and a half million. In En Certain Regard, and Olivier Assayas's Ciel Maria and Bertrand Bonello's Saint Laurent for about $8 million. Finally, the higher end, closer to an American budget, the $20 million for Michael Hazavitsius, his film called The Search, which is about $22 million on the Chechenian War. So Cannes is very important to the French in terms of distributing their cinema des auteurs, with French entries constituting 20% of the total of all Cannes films this year. The state of the cinema, which in no way competes with the U.S. in terms of money or films produced, and the U.S. itself, by the way, is only third behind Bollywood and Hollywood in total films, and about to be passed by China in terms of film revenues. But the U.S. does have a stranglehold on distribution. Here still, the Cinema des Auteurs operates in almost a mode of government financing and more artisanal production that has some similarities to the great French films of the 30s. It's still a bit more family-like rather than industrial in producing films. We'll just take a look at this week's Periscope, the going-out guide in Paris, like Time Out in New York, which is kind of funny that the going-out guide in New York has been outsourced to a franchise in London. But at any rate, take a look at the Periscope, and you'll find an extraordinary number of French films now playing in Paris. However, I do refer you to The Antidote and Candide, where Candide and Martin, the cynic, arrive in Paris and are astounded by the number of theatrical productions. How many, a flabbergasted Candide asked the bishop, their cultural guide. 80, says the bishop. That's extraordinary, says Candide. How many are any good? 4, says the bishop. That's extraordinary, says Martin, the cynic. And which is to say, many of the French films are sort of the French lovelorn films that can be trying, but there are also some very interesting films, such as the documentary Chalvet, The Conquest of Dignity, about the 70s French workers' movement. Plus, this is the center of global film culture. Nevertheless, French indies are vibrant and are even represented along with other global first-time indies in what has become the latest Cannes showcase called L'Acide, or ACID, the Association for Independent Cinema, which is its goal is to expose young directors. So while the French covered the potential cutting of grace as a slight on the Cinema des Auteurs, and used the occasion to debate whether this cinema can survive, the Americans in Variety took the narrower approach with the headline, Grace Drama, Harvey Won't Walk the Carpet. Back to the Croisette, the other controversy about Grace, and you must realize that's the way that Cannes is marketed by creating and promoting controversies, is one on the right. The royal family of Monaco claims that this is not the real story of Grace. The director took liberties, as of course directors always do, and he even declared he was not doing a biopic. But they felt Grace was not regal enough. The royal family thinks the film is too modern, and by too modern I mean that its sensibility is definitely post-1789 and the French Revolution. Their idea of a properly cinematic take on the princess seems to be centered around her as part of the court of the Sun King, or Louis XIV. The film also revolves around Monaco's, quote, independence. It takes place at a moment in 1962 when Monaco was being asked by de Gaulle to pay taxes to France, and they refused. The French called the principality Le Rocher, the Little Rock, and to paraphrase scripture, upon this little rock you will not pay taxes. It was a moment when Monaco, quote, stood up to de Gaulle and refused to pay. They stood up for their right to not pay taxes to the country which essentially houses them. What a political cause. The royals' version of the racist farmer in the U.S. who grazes off government land. In the film, then, Grace embarrasses de Gaulle by throwing a society ball, and Monaco overturns their attempt to make the royals pay in a clear victory for the 18th century over the 20th. Hooray for regression. On the theme of this being a lesser con, Hollywood chose not to let two of its films come, preferring to open them in the fall, aimed toward the Oscars, Iñárritu's Birdman and Paul Thomas Anderson's Inherent Vice. By the way, the Hollywood answer in the opening of the summer season to the Europeans' grace was Godzilla, which is also a kind of cinema royalty. The radioactive monster this time removed from Japan so as not too dangerously suggest Fukushima. The second major controversy involved the Affair DSK in the film Welcome to New York, and a new form of distribution using the festival itself to create controversy for the film, where being excluded is as good as being in. The New York bad boy director Abel Ferrara's film, based on the moment of Dominique Strauss-Kahn's arrest for sexual predatory behavior in New York, starred Gerald Depardieu as DSK. And the film was not invited to Cannes, so the Euro distributors, Wild Bunch, decided to open it at a theater on the Croisette on Saturday of opening week and make it available simultaneously as a video on demand on the telecharging networks. So the Affair DSK really became an affair of distribution, with in the end Wild Bunch outdoing Harvey Weinstein, who, by the way, benefited as much not going as and creating publicity as by going to Cannes. Wild Bunch is a major pan-European distributor, called a mini-major here, like the Weinsteins. In France, the translation is of the company Wild Bunch's Savage Horde. The company is an outgrowth of Canal Plus. It won the Palme d'Or last year with Life of Adele, had a popular success in Europe with a film called Neuf Mois Ferme, or 9 Months Pregnant, and this year with this film has pioneered a new distribution strategy involving direct video. They won the War of Distribution Worlds, or you might call it How to Make a Bad Film Relevant, and get it, it's 15 minutes, now reduced to about 15 seconds. And it wasn't even on the carpet, and nearly beat Grace for worldwide impact. The film was generally panned as adding nothing to any understanding of the DSK affair. Gerard Depardieu as DSK in it was a French equivalent of kind of an aging Jack Nicholson. The film was about the bloated lifestyle of the rich and does open with a montage of Washington and money, reminding us that DSK was the head of the IMF, but then degenerates into a long, boring orgy. Remember, Depardieu playing the indolent DSK is famous this last year himself for, like Grace in Monaco, not paying French taxes and leaving the country, becoming its best-known refugee. And the film does not even suggest that there may have been a political vendetta involved in this scandal, with Sarkozy having help in the U.S. to take out his then-main arrival for the election he eventually lost. In the end, the film was not a success. They had 48,000 telecharges on video on demand, one-third of what they anticipated. And at a press conference on Monday, Depardieu would not answer questions about the film. He was there instead to speak only about a soccer documentary called United Passions, kind of history of the World Cup. And remember, as I said, there's as much about the red carpet that has to do with competition, where the actual maneuvering is going on below, not above, in the market, which is the largest in the world. Hollywood storms in for the first week, closes deals in world cinema, and at this point has already left the festival. One of these deals involves Michael Hazavicius, the Oscar-winning helmer of The Artist, who at Cannes this year has a film called The Search about the Chechenian War, which is in the competition, but who will next direct Will, Paramount's comedy produced by Will Ferrell. His Cannes film is $20 million, which is huge by European standards, as I said, but small by American, and this signing by Paramount reveals that Hazavicius was all along just a Hollywood director masquerading as a European. To a couple of more serious matters, Jean-Luc Godard is represented twice in the festival. He has a film in the main competition titled Adieu à Langage, which I'll be talking about next week, or Goodbye to Language. And he has a section in an anthology film on Bosnia titled Bridges of Sarajevo. On the habitual Cannes question, will he or won't he attend, the answer this year is no. He did not attend last time either in 2010 for Film Socialism. He was quoted as saying, it doesn't serve me to go to Cannes, perhaps a comment on the frenzy of distribution that can often seem to overshadow the frenzy of creation. Finally, war as a topic was almost specifically chosen by Thierry Frémaux, the head of Cannes programming. War films are very prominent in the festival this year, which Le Monde focused its opening article on, implying that they were, as a group, critical. Instead, that's not necessarily true. They instead break into those promoting colonial wars and those opposed to war. On one side, there's the war in Syria in Silver Waters, which is a sort of war that is against the socialist regime. On another film, taking the side of the Chechenians against the Russians, The Search has Hazavicius' promotion of the European European Cold War. And Sergei Loznitsa comparing the Orange Revolution to that of Egypt in the documentary Maidan, when in fact it's simply a civil war and the revolution is about wanting more European money and goods. Against this stands the anthology about Bosnia, Sarajevo, with Romanian director Christian Pugh, called Bridges of Sarajevo, and also against the background of France about to embark on a military mission in Nigeria, with the excuse that they're fighting the terrorism of Boko Haram, which is most likely a cover for active colonial engagement, and his country is trying desperately to throw off the colonial yoke. Against this stands Timbuktu, or Song of the Birds, by the inheritor of Usman Sembene in African cinema, Abdulrahim Sissaku. Was shot in Mauritania, but it's about the after effects of the French invasion of Mali. And the final say in the war films, as an answer to the reactionary colonialist pro-war, The Hurt Locker, is the French director Laurent Renard's Of Men in War, or, you know, Of Arms in the Man, of which Aeneas sang, which is about the post-traumatic stress syndrome in California. War films this year are both pro and anti-colonial and pro and anti-war. Not as Le Monde would have it, simply a liberal, why can't we all get along? By the way, just as a footnote, in annexing the Crimea, Putin also snared Yalta, which is the major site for shooting Russian films. And Russians have forbidden Crimean halls to show Ukrainian films, since prior to the annexation, the Americans had forbidden distribution of Russian films in the Ukraine. And last, there's also a set of films on the immigration question, particularly that of those wanderers who challenge the European state, generally go under the name of gypsies. There's a big film in the Canzon des Riolais tour called Eat Your Dead on a gypsy formation called the Yaniche and their lifestyle. Another on Algerian gitans called Geronimo by Tony Gatlift of Lacho Drome fame. And the third on the Roms from the Czech Republic called Sestaven. And on that note, it's time for me to be wandering back down the quest set, but I will see you all next week on Bro and the World Film Beat with a report on films by Ken Loach, Mike Lee, Godard, the Dardennes, Tommy Lee Jones, and David Cronenberg. A biento.
You're listening to Alternative Outlook Radio. I'm your host, James Simmons. Next up, we have an interview with Thomas John Cameron, who is a houseless vet, and it is a continuation on our houseless narratives segments that we have had over the weeks.
All right, Thomas, what led to your unfortunate circumstances?
In service, I was used to gamble, but it was only for fun. But when I got some, I was hit by a car in 88 and got a settlement of $125,000 and then gambled it, most of it away, and became a compulsive gambler. I spent, the worst time was 22 hours at the tables down Atlantic City, and I didn't care what I was doing. And now when I went to gambling treatment program in Brecksville, Ohio, they said my gambling was really hiding depression. I would use that as medication.
As a coping mechanism?
Yes.
I'm sorry to hear that. And it must have been very tough.
Yeah. One time I nearly wanted to, after losing so badly, I wanted to walk in the Atlantic Ocean and drown myself. But just my faith, Catholic faith, didn't. If I did that, I wouldn't be able to be buried in a Catholic cemetery.
What was your childhood like?
Growing up, I was picked on. I was shy. I liked to read. Stay in the library and read for 2-3 hours, maybe even 4 hours, just reading different books after doing my homework. So I'm 53 and I've read over 2,000 books in my lifetime.
Wow, that's impressive.
And I went to Union County College, graduated with a liberal arts urban affairs
urban studies, was political science, public administration, sociology, psychology, economics, art history I took as a minor, as an elective, and what was the other things? Biology, general biology.
Do you get any support from the government?
I get $985 a month for a non-service-connected pension. I'm trying to put in for full 100% disability. I was also receiving 40% disability, 50% disability for asthma, anaphylaxis, and back condition.
Is it enough?
Just about enough. Just enough to stay here and be able to eat well.
So you're a veteran?
Yes.
What service were you in?
Army, 82nd Airborne. So I went in June 20th, 1974 to June 26th. 1976.
So Vietnam.
Vietnam
era.
No, one, 2 years only. I never went overseas.
Do you feel that the government does enough for veterans?
They could do more, especially in now that there's a severe recession, then there's too many homeless vets.
40% of the homeless population is what I've read.
Yes.
Veterans. It's kind of, I think that's a pretty sad figure.
I signed on that paper and put up my right hand saying I would defend this country with my life. And now I went for jobs when I first got out. They said that you had no experience. Your military experience doesn't qualify you for this job.
What do you think the government could do to make things better with veteran relations?
Do a little bit more with people return, do more transitional programs to help people find jobs. Because once you're out, you're on your own, right? Unless you need vocational training with the veterans, right? Vocational rehabilitation, that's what they call it. I did that for about 6 months and they couldn't find me anything either.
You think maybe the government also misappropriates some of their funds, puts a lot of money into
yes,
things?
Yes, into studying the sex life of caribou in Alaska, right?
Pork barrel spending.
And also studying the life cycle of the Maine lobster. $2.1 billion for something like that.
Seems like they have their priorities a little messed
right.
up. Yeah, I think maybe also, you know, we spend billions of dollars bailing out banks. And billions of dollars bailing out auto industry, but
right.
we can't even give any money to help out our veterans.
That was really bad. I mean, with the bank bailout, it was almost $800 billion. Or over $800 billion. A fraction of that would help veterans immensely. Just $4 billion would help a lot, right?
Yeah, and yet you know, bankers have a lot of money, and a lot of veterans don't have
right.
much money. Maybe that's why they got the money, because
yeah.
they have the influence and the money. I just wanted to ask if there's anything you felt you've missed, or that I've missed, that you would like to add.
No, just that I was in service, I had a bit of a hard time not adapting to the rigid program, right? I didn't have any Article 15s, and I didn't have any court martials, but they wanted me out because they were reduction in force. A riff was during when Carter became president, right? And then they cut the military and veterans 15 to 20%. That's all.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
On Wednesday, June 4th, the Denver City Council Government and Finance Committee passed a budget request for $1.8 million supplemental appropriation for Denver Police and Sheriff Department for increased security presence. What that means is, if this proposal ultimately is passed by City Council, $900,000 would be spent to add 10 police officers to patrol the so-called hotspots of the 16th Street Mall, the Bullpark neighbourhood, that's where the St. Francis Centre and the Rescue Mission, Samaritan House and other homeless services are located, as well as Lodo. The proposal has angered many homelessness advocates in Denver who say that this is just more criminalisation of the homeless community. Joining me now from our Denver studio, we have members of the advocacy group Denver Homeless Out Loud, Therese Howard and Ray Lyle. Good morning to you both.
Morning.
Good morning.
Well, tell us about this proposal. Where is this coming from, this request to have additional resources for additional policing for this downtown Denver downtown area? Trez?
Well, it's actually a proposal from Mayor Hancock. He's sort of the source of it. And he made this announcement for the proposal at the same time at which there was an agreement brought before City Council for an addition to be built on the Denver Rescue Mission, which is a major shelter downtown. And the Ballpark Neighborhood Association was very upset about this. They have consistently pushed back against any increased services or anything that will help homeless people in that neighborhood. And so when the Denver Rescue Mission was proposing for an expansion, the Ballpark pushed back against that. And in response to that, Mayor Hancock told the Ballpark Neighborhood Association, well, in exchange for this, in a sense, we'll propose to have 10 new police officers put in those neighborhoods to police these quote-unquote homeless crimes.
Well, city officials and Mayor Hancock are saying that these extra police officers are not specifically to target the homeless community, but rather it's around criminal activity. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's pretty simple. They said specifically urinating in alleys, panhandling. These were brought up in the city council meeting. And the other one was, I'm sorry.
Smoking weed and sleeping in public.
Pot smoking and sleeping in public. Now, the pot smoking, yeah, we could blame the general public for that. But in reality, I mean, they're targeting homeless people. I'm down there every day on the mall. I ride my bike through all the areas every day, through the alleys, down the streets, and I see them already policing the homeless.
Well, what are your responses to people who live in that area, who not members of the homeless community, who say, well, these issues like public urination, panhandling, other issues, that they're public nuisance and it does create problems for the residents of the neighbourhood? What are the alternatives instead of having an increased police presence? Do homelessness advocates and groups like yourselves, do you have solutions that could maybe mediate some of these issues between residents in housed areas and the homeless community?
Number one, laws against sleeping are criminalization of a basic act of survival, so that should not exist, period. But in terms of other things like people's need to urinate and ask for money when you have none, there's some pretty obvious solutions to those, in our opinion, and what we're sort of asking of the city council is drop this proposal for $1.8 million to be spent on increased policing and detention and arrest fees, and instead use that $1.8 million for positive solutions to these actual problems. So the problems, if they're referencing, are panhandling, sleeping in public, public urination, and whatnot. Panhandling, an obvious solution to that is employment. When we did some math, you could employ 58 people full-time for $15 an hour for that $1.8 million. Public urination, obvious solution, bathrooms. There's these things called urban rest stops in Seattle that have not only bathrooms, but also showers and lockboxes and washing machines and whatnot. And they maintain those for $600,000 a year. So we could have... We could maintain three urban rest stops for the $1.8 million that they're doing. Same with there's a Portland Loos. These are sort of like single stall bathrooms in Portland that are solar powered and nicely cleaned and have a toilet and a sink. That costs $90,000. So we could actually purchase 17 and maintain 17 Portland Loos for that $1.8 million, as well as talking about then sleeping, the issue of people needing somewhere to sleep. We could pay for 206 people to have an apartment for a year for that $1.8 million, or we could also purchase for the price in which Madison, Wisconsin is building tiny homes. They're building them for $5,000 a piece. It's a cheap way of doing it, but we could build 360 tiny homes for that $1.8 million.
So given that the city of Denver and city officials are saying that they want to help with the homeless situation, and you say there are some obvious solutions that could be, you know, that they could come up with, where is the disconnect? What needs to happen so that some of these solutions that you are pointing to that are being very successful in some other cities, how can they be implemented here in Denver?
Education, just simply letting the general public know that this stuff is going on and there are solutions. There's a couple of places here in town that are doing stuff, but they're not doing it fast enough or well enough. Just opening up a rest stop for us for some 10,000 plus people is really not cutting it. We need jobs. We need places to sleep. It's just something they really need to get involved in. The general public needs to know this stuff. They need to come to Denver Homeless Out Loud and get involved with us and know what's going on.
Well, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Trace.
I was just going to add something that Councilwoman Kanish said at the meeting was that there needs to be as quick a response to solutions as there is to increase police. So that's what we see often is every time something comes up around homelessness, it's like, okay, well, let's put more police. And that happens really fast, like within a month. But alternatively, nothing happens in terms of pushing that quickly for this much money, $1.8 million, to be spent toward these solutions. So if the city council would actually get behind it and say, no, we're going to push this as hard as we push more police, that could go somewhere because $1.8 million could be spent on all these other things.
Well, this $1.8 million budget request has yet to be approved by city council. Is there any indication as to when council will take up this matter?
We're still unsure. Probably sometime in the next few weeks, maybe not this week, probably maybe next week, the week after. We don't know.
Well, we'll continue to follow it here at KGNU, and we will be planning an extended discussion on this particular issue, including members of Denver Homeless Out Loud. Therese Howard and Ray Lyle joined us this morning from our studio. Thank you so much for being with us.
A potentially game-changing ruling has come down in Los Angeles with respect to teacher security and education and the privatizing of education in the United States. What's your take on it?
Basically, what happened, Michael, is that last week a judge ruled that tenure laws have deprived students of their right to an education under the California State Constitution and has violated their civil rights. This sends a blow to teachers' unions and could radically alter how California teachers are hired and fired, and I think will prompt challenges to tenure laws in other states.
Well, that's what the right wing is predicting, that this is going to put some wind in their sails. The judge, who was a Republican appointee, ironically cited Brown versus the Board of Education and its equal protection argument, and said that these poor children are not receiving equal protection because they've got teachers there that are tenured and therefore can't be fired. And the reason, and this is key, the reason these people say that kids are getting a bad education is that they have bad teachers. Well, we all know that there's a lot of reasons why these kids don't make it, starting with the fact, say, that they don't get breakfast in the morning. So what are we talking about here? They want to dismantle the trade unions that the teachers have built and substitute private commodity schools for public education.
We're going to have a longer report on this case on Law and Disorder because it's really critical. And as Michael Smith said, it's about privatizing school. It's about the struggle for public education. It's about unions and destroying unions. And we've seen this going on for a long time. If anybody saw the movie Waiting for Superman, that is also about charter schools, getting rid of unions, and really getting rid of public education. So this is very serious what's happening in California. And let's also see where it comes from. It's a millionaire Silicon Valley person financed it for over a number of years, set up the organization that ultimately litigated it, brought in certain kinds of plaintiffs who happened to be poor and felt that they weren't getting, probably were not getting a good education, and then hired the best lawyers he could find for this kind of case.
Ted Olson, the Solicitor General under Bush.
Former Solicitor General
Ted Olson. So these children are in effect being used as pawns.
Precisely. The case is called Vergara versus the State of California and the California Teachers Union. Stay tuned.
I want to be careful about the word pawns, Heidi, because you know, it is true that in this country, poor children, black children, Latino children, do not get a very good education. And they're struggling with how do they deal with it. And you know, people put forth, well, you can't fire your bad teachers. You know, we'll get set up a charter school. We'll do this. We'll do that. And so it's... Pawns is a way to say it, but in fact, there's a real issue here of how do we educate our population. And the neoliberal model, which is what's really going on here, we're having our country and Arne Duncan, as Michael Smith said, the Commissioner of Education, support this kind of getting rid of tenure, getting rid of unions, privatizing the schools, rather than putting massive more amounts of money into the schools, improving the schools.
Paying teachers more.
Paying teachers what they deserve for teaching, et cetera. Right. They're doing it this way. And it's all part and parcel of the America that is today, of a neoliberal America.
Right.
The alleged kidnapping of three teenaged Israeli settlers has sparked an increase in Israeli military actions in the Palestinian territories this week. Israeli soldiers shot dead at least two Palestinians in the West Bank Friday, including a 15-year-old boy. Israeli authorities also clamped down on Palestinian detainees in Israeli jails, where for nearly 2 months, more than 140 have been on hunger strike to demand that Israeli authorities either release them or bring them to trial. Dozens have been hospitalized and are facing the threat of force feedings. FSRN's Rami Almagari has more.
Outside the offices of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Gaza City, Misbah Abid Rabbu, the 58-year-old father of a detainee, has laid fasting on a bed for the past 6 weeks. Misbah's son, Raji, has been in Israeli detention for more than 4 years.
A prisoner of war is one taken from a combat tank, not one taken from his or her home. When the Israelis came to our neighborhood of Abed Rabo, they vandalized the whole area, including bulldozing homes and trees, quite similar to an earthquake or like a tsunami.
In 2009, during the Israeli attack on the territory known as Kaslid, Misbah's son was arrested, charged with helping Palestinian resistance fighters, and sentenced to 5 years in prison. This week, Israeli authorities tightened the conditions of confinement for Palestinian detainees. The move follows last week's disappearance of a three Israeli settler youth in Hebron City. According to the West Bank's Mandela Institution for the Defense of Palestinian Detainees, the Israeli army has stormed a number of West Bank areas and rounded up more than 200 Palestinians and the crackdown. Nearly 50 of those were rearrested, having been released from jail in a 2011 Egypt-mediated swap deal between Hamas and Israel that freed more than 1,000 detainees from Israeli prisons in return for the release of Gilad Shalit, an Israeli soldier captured in Gaza in a cross-border attack in 2006. Buthaina Dukmak is the director of the Mandela Institution.
Israeli authorities have now deprived detainees of access to TVs, newspapers, some foods, as well as the right to family visits for 1 week. Israel also imposed a collective punishment on the entire Gaza Strip. All this happens even though no one has yet claimed responsibility for capturing the missing settlers.
Israel accuses the Islamist Hamas party of kidnapping the three missing settlers, though neither Hamas nor any Palestinian group has claimed responsibility. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called the matter a serious incident that will have grave consequences. The Israeli military has also stepped up activity in Gaza, with airstrikes damaging several public facilities, including 10 schools. Ziad Thabit is Deputy Education Minister in Gaza.
The ministry calls on all international organizations and human rights groups to take a firm stance towards Israeli attacks against our school children and schools. These attacks are in clear violation of all humanitarian and international norms.
Israel says the attacks came in response to rocket fire from Gaza. The latest spate of military action also targeted several training camps belonging to Hamas and other armed groups in Gaza, such as the Nasser Salah al-Din Brigade. Local political analysts suggest that the latest Israeli crackdown, along with Israeli political campaigning against Hamas, aims to undermine the recent unity deal between the Islamist Hamas, which Israel calls terrorist, and Fatah Party of Western-backed Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. Rami Al-Mighari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
At last, our political leaders in Washington are taking action for low-wage workers and the middle class, striking a blow for America's historic value of economic fairness. Gosh, I hope you don't think I meant Washington, D.C. No, no, the same old corporate mentality of stripping any semblance of ethics from the work ethic still rules in that plutocratic roost. Rather than D.C., it's Washington State I'm talking about. Specifically, the progressive forces of Seattle, who've just produced a landmark $15 an hour minimum wage. Instead of just talking about the widening gap of inequality and wishing Congress might give a damn about the millions of Americans being knocked down, the people of Seattle are providing national leadership. We did it. Workers did this, Shama Sawant said, a member of Occupy Seattle. She's been the tenacious, articulate leader of a large grassroots coalition of low-wage workers called 15 Now, and she was elected to the city council last year by building the case for a $15 wage floor. In addition, Mayor Ed Murray campaigned last year for raising the minimum to $15, indexed to inflation, and this year he pulled together a 24-member working group of labor and business interests, which has spent 4 months hammering out details of the local ordinance. On June 2nd, all 9 city council members voted to adopt it. This is Jim Hightower saying, of course, the forces of corporate greed never sleep. And a Washington, D.C. group called the International Franchise Association is unleashing a pack of lawyers to sue the city, hoping a federal judge will nullify the will of local voters. So the political fight is not over. But the good people of Seattle have done all of us a big favor by moving the wage debate from the miserly, self-centered turf of the corporate bottom line to the moral high ground of social justice, where it belongs. Seattle is just the start of this movement.
WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has marked 2 years of confinement at Ecuador's embassy in London. Assange has been holed up inside the embassy since June 2012 to avoid extradition to Sweden, where he faces questioning on allegations of sexual assault. Assange has voiced fears he would ultimately be sent for prosecution to the United States should he return to Sweden. Speaking via satellite to a news conference in Ecuador, Assange thanked the Ecuadorian government and his supporters.
The Ecuadorian people can be proud that their country has stood up to intense pressure. received many slanders from press associated with the United States and some associated with the United Kingdom. I am thankful to that resistance and also to the loyalty and resistance of my staff.
Ecuador says talks with Britain over Assange's fate are again at an impasse, with Britain refusing to grant Assange safe passage to Quito.
That concludes this episode of Alternative Outlook. I hope you enjoyed the program. And don't forget to visit us at alternativeoutlook.org. And remember that the revolution begins in the mind of a child.